Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia.
We started to burn too many things we found. That's the great Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song. We're back for another hour here at the Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you to the crew in New York. And thank you to Craig Unger, who is joining us. Craig, you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear, as I did on my transcontinental flight from Newark to Los Angeles 2 days ago, where I read your amazing book, House of Trump, House of Putin. So we're going to have you alone for a half hour here, and then we're going to be joined by two great experts in energy, and we'll hope you. We want to expand that conversation to the particulars of nuclear power and other energy sources in terms of Trump's mob background. But the importance of your book is hard to overstate. Forgive me if I...
Thank you.
Well, forgive me if I paraphrase it incorrectly, but I want to start from the top, Craig, and I've been following your excellent work for years and years, including your book on the Bush family, which I do want to get into. But let me see if I get this straight. In a week in which we've got two major guilty verdicts, one a guilty plea and an eighth guilty verdicts against two guys who could not have been closer to Donald Trump, unless they were maybe Stormy Daniels, but that's another story. By the way,
that's absolutely true.
I can't resist telling this, and I'm sure you'll be amused by this, Craig Unger. I have lived most of my life in Columbus, Ohio. I now live in L.A., but I was back in July. And Stormy Daniels had been booked for two nights into a strip joint in Columbus. And on the first night, the cops arrested her on stage, for God's sakes. I mean, that's just insane. If I'd have been there, I'd have been livid. But in order to support her, she was rebooked at another club the next night. And I went there with Bob Fitrakis, my co-author, and we watched Stormy Daniels dance. I'm 72, so it doesn't have quite the same resonance it used to. But she did come out in a after being announced as the number one guest in the history of 60 Minutes, at least in the last 10 years. She came out in an Uncle Sam costume, which she proceeded to shed. And it was just, but she didn't give any speeches or anything like that. But I got to say that I now have seen Stormy Daniels pretty much in the buff. And what can I tell you? So there you go. I had to throw that in. But let me see if I understand your book correctly. What you are saying, and as best I can tell, in House of Trump, House of Putin, which is, I guess, what, a Penguin book? Is that who's published it? Dutton?
Dutton, which is part of Penguin Random House. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to highly recommend it to anyone listening to this show. If I understand it correctly, what you're saying is that since the 1980s, because Donald Trump is such a miserable businessman and kept going bankrupt, that he could only get money from the Russian mafia, and which was at the time beginning to dismantle the Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union was still intact until 1991, but in the interim, in the 80s, the Soviet Union was collapsing, and the Russian mafia, we won't call it the Soviet mafia, it was obviously the Russian mafia, was dismantling and grabbing hold of the public assets of the Soviet Union, and billionaires were being created. And these were the guys, these were the only people that would fund Donald Trump. and they started buying his condos, you said 1,300 deals that you know of, with cash that they were laundering through the Trump enterprises, and that therefore, as of the 1980s until the present, Donald Trump's entire financial fortune, such as it is, financial well-being or whatever, has been dependent on Russian mafia cash. Is that a fair assessment of what you're saying in House of Trump, House of Putin?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. In fact, Donald Trump is a horrible businessman. And when he went into Atlantic City, he overexpanded to an astonishing degree and emerged $4 billion in debt with six bankruptcies. So he could not possibly get a loan from any Western bank after that. And the way he came back, his comeback, was with was through the Russians. And Russia, as we now know, is sort of a mafia state. So all the natural resources were basically being seized by the oligarchs and the Russian mafia. And since Putin has been president of Russia, there's been more than $1 trillion in flight capital. And that money needs to be laundered. It's no good being a billionaire if you can't get your money into the Western banking system. So it needs to be laundered, and the best way to launder vast, vast sums of money is through real estate. And it would be great to have a real estate mogul who sells luxury condos, no questions asked. Donald Trump loves doing business with gangsters because they pay top dollar, and that's because they need to launder their money.
God. Okay, so can you describe the money laundering process? What does it mean to launder money?
Well, it's very simple, and there are really two criteria that set off alarm bells with the anti-money laundering people. And one is anonymous shell companies. And when I say that about 20% of Trump's condos were sold through were laundered, it means they were sold to anonymous owners through these shell companies. They're generally quite often limited liability corporations, and they are generally all cash purchases. That is the other criteria. So, and you see this going on again and again through Trump properties, a total of 1,300 transactions like that in the United States alone, and holdings overseas.
What is the time frame for those 1,300 transactions?
Well, I started.
When did they occur?
Starting in 1984, and that's one thing that I don't believe you can fully understand what's happening today unless you understand the history behind them. So I went back to the beginning, and I wanted to see how and why this started, and I went through their public databases, if you're interested in real estate, that show the ownership of every single property in the state of New York. And I examined the Trump properties whenever I found a condo that was owned by what appeared to be a Russian name. I would Google, and again and again I found, oops, they were indicted for money laundering, or they were gunned down on Sixth Avenue, one crime after another. This is 721 Fifth Avenue. Trump Tower is a very, very high crime neighborhood.
Wow. I've never heard that. 721 Fifth Avenue. Now, what's the cross street there?
That's it's either 58th or 59th. I'm not exactly sure. Secret Service people there.
So that's right. It's a corner. That's the prime corner in New York City.
Absolutely. That's prime location. I mean, that is the rich. I mean, that is, as Trump calls it, the Tiffany location. And in fact, Tiffany's is literally around the corner. That is the heart of the high end shopping district in Manhattan.
And how many units are there in 721? Fifth Avenue.
Well, it's roughly 300. I may be off by 10 or 20%. It may be, but it's roughly that many. Typically everything Donald Trump says, there's a lie in there somewhere. So, and he says he lives on the 68th floor. it happens to be a 58-story building. And this is one of the problems I encountered. People accused me of making a mistake on another building when I found someone who lived on the 79th floor of what was really a 72-story building. But Donald Trump, believe it or not, numbers his floors wrong to make his building seem bigger.
So what does he do? Does he skip numbers?
He will say there's an atrium, and he'll say, well, that's 13 stories, and it's a 60-foot atrium, and it's not 13 stories. He does that. That's the kind of thing he does.
God, it's fantastic. I mean, who could have, if you had written a novel and invented Donald Trump as a character, I think everybody would dismiss it as just not credible. But let's talk again with this, with the mafia angle on Donald Trump's family background. You talk in the book about tell us if you can trace his roots back to where it's relevant here with the underworld.
Well, he sort of was no virgin when it came to organized crime. His grandfather, during the gold rush, had a brothel. I mean, I guess so. He sort of dabbled in organized crime. Fred Trump, his father, was a real estate developer in the outer boroughs of Queens and Brooklyn, and he had links to the Italian mafia that Trump grew up with, knowing all about them. But the Russian mafia is a different animal entirely, and it's a wonderfully colorful subculture. They started partnering with the Italian mafia, and that's how it all began. And I'm going back to the 80s, and Trump's lawyer at the time, younger listeners may not know about him, but his lawyer at the time until 1986 was Roy Cohn, who was sort of the satanic dark prince of American politics during the McCarthy era of the 50s. And in many ways, he was Trump's mentor. He was a bit of a thug. I actually had a run-in with Roy Cohn way back in the 80s when I was an editor at New York Magazine. And he called me up and yelled at me and tried to get me to kill a story. And I'm pleased to say that we ran it. And the people in question went to jail.
I'm surprised he didn't ask you to kill an editor in addition to the story.
His bark in this case was worse than its bite. But he was sort of a brute, and he taught Trump how to bully, and Trump has been known to yell in recent years, "Where's my Roy Cohn?" Even during the Trump-Russia scandal in recent months.
Well, he had a Michael Cohn anyway. That seems to have...
Precisely. And Michael Cohn was sort of a Roy Cohn 2.0. He wasn't quite as effective. Roy Cohn was a real power broker in a way that Michael Cohn strived to be but never quite made.
No, and Roy Cohn never was... was Roy Cohn convicted and put in prison for any of his wrongdoing?
He was disbarred shortly before his death, and I believe he was not put in jail, but I believe he was convicted. He did die of AIDS, I think, in 1986.
Yes, that's right. And as you point out, he was a homophobe who was gay.
And a Jewish anti-Semite, a homophobe who was gay, and he was full of contradictions.
Thank God he didn't have any kids. So the question now becomes, how thoroughly, at this point in time, how thoroughly is Donald Trump controlled by Vladimir Putin? I mean, Putin has been the mob boss of the Russian oligarchs since officially since right after Yeltsin was gotten rid of in the early 90s, right? Assume he had a strong power base among the so-called oligarchs before that. But clearly when he became the leader of the new Russia, he was the Don Corleone of the Russian mob. Although I guess, I don't know if there's a family structure in Russia, but he seems to have a dominance over the Russian mob that no single mobster in the U.S. ever had. Is that correct?
Well, yes, you know, I interviewed a former general in the KGB, General Oleg Kalugin, who had been head of counterintelligence to the KGB, but it was just outside of Washington, D.C. now. He's obviously defected, and he is not going back to Russia, I'm telling you that. He would be in real trouble if he did. But when I asked him about the Russian mafia, he said, oh, it's just another part of the KGB. It's part of the government. And I think when Americans hear the word mafia, they think of the Godfather and the Italian-American mafia. The fundamental difference in Russia is when Russia is a real mafia state, it means there is a really dark mafia that's enormously powerful. There's no Wall Street in Russia. There's no Goldman Sachs. And the people with real financial acumen go to work for the mafia because that's where the money is. So when you start to understand this, a certain light bulb went off in me, and I realized, wait a minute, these people, many of them were living in Trump Tower. To some extent, they were operating in Trump Tower.
In New York?
The home of the man who is now president of the United States on and off for more than 30 years. Now, if that's not a security risk, a security breach, I don't know what is. And quite recently, of course, we saw that Trump revoked security clearances for John Brennan. I would argue that if any person should not have a security clearance, it's Donald Trump. I mean, this is can you imagine any other politician who is living in the same building with all these Russian mobsters, and he's benefiting from them financially, and they have ties directly to Russian intelligence.
So how significant is basically Trump Tower the headquarters for the world headquarters for the Russian mafia, or just for the New York branch?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, but I go back, as I say, to the 80s and 90s, and in the early 90s, the FBI was chasing the local leader of the Russian mafia. They were looking for him all over Brooklyn, which is where most of them live and is considered to be the base of operations in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. And they finally gave up, and they found him. His name was Vaclav Ivankov, and they finally found it. Well, he lived at 721 Fifth Avenue in Trump Tower. And in his Rolodex, you found Trump's phone number. So they've been in and out of there for many, many years. In 2013, there was a big gambling bust of a money laundering ring. And what I would argue, I found that Trump has said he has no contacts with Russians. I found at least 59. And believe me, there are many, many more. And many of these contacts are tied to the Russian mafia. And I would argue they're not random. They're not coincidental. And this was a deliberate operation to entrap and compromise Donald Trump, and it succeeded.
Did you say 59 he's had contact with, or who live in Trump Tower?
No, 59 he's had contact with, not that they all live in Trump Tower.
How many would you say live in Trump Tower?
You know, I don't have a number off the top of my head, but if you want Trump properties, it's not just Trump Tower. There's Trump World Tower, which is near the United Nations, just a few blocks away. That's I think it's roughly an 80-story building. There's Sunny Isles, Florida, which has several Trump towers, and there have been a lot of criminal activity in those buildings as well.
All right, so here's the question to me. You know, I can't watch it anymore, but Don Lemon, Rachel Maddow, Lawrence O'Donnell, all these guys on MSNBC and CNN, every night they rant and rant at Trump. They never talk about his organized crime. I mean, to me, reading your book is like, why is this guy still walking around? And why do these people on the networks, the CNN, the cable networks, that obviously hate Trump so much? I mean, he did everything in his power to...
You know, that's a really good question. And I To be honest, this book is taking off, and it will be on the bestseller list next week. But I had a very difficult time initially with just getting the story published in a magazine. And I think a lot of people say, oh, that's old news, because there were crime stories on the tabloid, in the crime pages of the tabloids, the New York Post and the New York Daily News, about various busts in Trump Tower. And, you know, this is 20, 30 years ago, so no one really put it together that these are serious ties to Russia, that this is part of an organized operation designed to compromise Trump. I mean, look at his wealth. I mean, he was completely bankrupt, $4 billion in debt, 6 bankruptcies. They come back and save him financially, make him a multi-billionaire again. He could never have had a political career of $4 billion in debt. And even his success on The Apprentice, that came after the Russian mafia came to his aid.
But why is it, you know, okay, I mean, you and I have been in the media for a long, long time. And to me, this is game over. This is... Why isn't Don Lemon and Rachel Maddow talking about this night after night?
I've been on Don Lemon talking about it. Rachel has not bit yet. Maybe she will. But I've gotten a fair amount of exposure on MSNBC, so I'm not complaining. I'm hoping now it will take off. But you know, some of the objections you get is, oh, there are too many Russian names. Well, I'm sorry. It's hard to write about these people. That's their names. I'm not going to call Semyon Mogilevich something like Billy. The other thing is that these are complicated names, and I have trouble with them. I don't speak Russian or anything, but Osama bin Laden was a very, very unfamiliar name until 9/11, and I believe someone like Semyon Mogilevich is of similar importance, and maybe he will become a household name at some time, but it takes a lot of familiarity, and that has not happened yet.
Man, I you know, I got to tell you, you know, I have met also David K. Johnson. I don't know if you work with him. Oh, his.
I think he's terrific. I have talked with him, but he's very, very good.
Yeah, and he's been following Trump for all these years, and I mean, this is the story. You know, I have a lot of friends in the peace movement who are very concerned that we're demonizing Russia. And and I think with some credibility, they say, well, at least if Trump's in the White House, we're not going to go to war with Russia. They're going to take us over. But that's a different story. Whereas Hillary Clinton might have gone to war with them because she hated Putin so much. And there is some credibility to that. She was not a stable character in my world. And so I guess the one good thing is we're not going to Russia, but war with Russia. But to what extent can we separate the Russian government from the Russian mob? Or is this like, are they of a piece here?
Well, they are of a piece. The Russian mafia operates at the they serve at the pleasure of the president, of Putin. And occasionally they get in trouble. Semyon Mogilevich was jailed for tax evasion for a while, and then he finally got out and in Russia. Yes, he has been he was indicted in the United States. And one thing that I find really, really scary is, you know who his lawyer was in the United States? It was William K. Sessions, head of the FBI, former head of the FBI.
Oh yeah. You mentioned that. No relation.
Right.
What is the basis of the fortune of the Russian mafia? When we talk about mafia, what business are these guys in?
Well, it has a long, long storied history going back to the era of the Tsars. And there was real anti-Semitism in Russia for centuries and for years. I mean, Stalin sent thousands and thousands of Jews to the Gulag. And over time, the toughest of the tough emerged as the Bratva, the Brotherhood, which became sort of the basis of the Russian mafia. And it's got its own code of ethics, its own hierarchy, a very elaborate system of exotic tattoos and its own language to some extent. And you saw that start to migrate over here after 1974. It was the unintended consequence of a bill passed, you may remember, I think your younger listeners won't, Senator Henry Scoop Jackson had a bill in 1974 that was designed to aid Soviet Jewry and allow Soviet Jews to emigrate to the United States. Well, Leonid Brezhnev was head of the Soviet Union back then, and he was sort of prefigured Fidel Castro, and the, if you remember the Mariel Boatlift of 1980, and essentially opened the doors to all the Soviet prisons, and they flooded out, and they came right into Brighton Beach here in New York, about 10 miles from where I live, and there you saw the Russian mafia start to expand into the United States. And they, in terms of businesses, back in the Soviet Union, they used to do black marketeering, extortion, prostitution, and the like. And they brought some of that over here. But over time, they sort of began to go white collar and do very sophisticated financial crimes. They went to Wall Street. And this was Semyon Mogilevich, who was the financial genius behind the Russian mafia, had all these spectacular crimes, and they became enormously profitable. So they had to launder money. And as far as I can tell, that seems to have started in 1984.
And they used, and Trump was the, Trump their primary guy?
He was the first, and they met in Trump Tower in 1984. A guy named David Bogdan, who had ties to the Russian mafia, went to Trump Tower. He delivered $6 million in cash. That's the equivalent of about $15 million today, by the way. And he said, I'll take five condos. And that, in effect, according to the State Attorney General of New York, was an act of money laundering. And, of course, Trump would say, well, I had no knowledge of where the money was coming from. And, I can't prove what he knows or doesn't know. But there is such a thing as willful ignorance in the law. It's a legal concept. And Trump did this at least 1,300 times. And I got to think, did he figure it out after 1,300 times?
Yeah, right.
If I were a prosecutor, I might make a case that he intentionally turned a blind eye.
Well, he couldn't have been personally involved in all 1,300 transactions.
He has lawyers. He has people who can do things for him.
Right. I assume David Cohen handled some of them. That's amazing.
Michael Cohen may have at the very beginning, but he died in 86, so it went on long afterwards.
So we're talking here with Craig Unger, author of this astounding book, House of Trump, House of Putin. I cannot believe that this is not game over for this guy. But, you know, the only other president that I know of that had deep mafia ties was Nixon. Now, Nixon was tied to the Sicilian-Italian mafia, and his primary go-through guy was Bibi Rebozo, as best I can tell. I worked for a magazine in 1972 called Sundance. It was one of those three-issue psychedelic wonder magazines, and a guy named Jeff Gerth, who you may have known, went on to be a major investigator for the New York Times. Had this many, many thousand word piece that I edited for Sundance. And, you know, I tell you, when we were in this building in San Francisco, I kept wondering when the doors were going to be broken down and the guys were going to come in with submachine guns. But we put the piece out and it had zero impact. I mean, zero. I mean, we just, in the middle of the 1972 election, we got it. Allegedly, George McGovern read a copy and, you know, nobody seemed to care. Now, in your book, House of Bush, House of Saud, you detail the connections between the Bush family and the Saudis. Can you talk about that a bit and maybe make some parallels?
Right. Well, there absolutely are some parallels. In fact, I'll tell you something that happened just after I published House of Bush, House of Saud. I gave a talk at Columbia University, and the guy in the audience came up to me, and it turns out he was with the Russian consulate. And he invited me to lunch. He took me out to lunch. And I was just curious. And House of Bush, House of Saud was about a young group of Saudis who went into Texas, and it happens I grew up in Texas, and they used the American system. They used a lobbying system of K Street lobbyists, partly, and various business ventures to worm their way into the orbit of the family of the Bush family. That includes both George H.W. Bush Sr., and his son, George W. Bush. So I began to see how close they got to the Bush family. And as a result, I believe George W. Bush sort of turned a blind eye to what was really going on in Saudi Arabia, and that created a real security breach that led to 9/11. So the Russians Wow. were quite interested in that. And I think one of the lessons is, there's a wonderful Washington saying that sometimes the biggest scandal isn't what's illegal, it's what's legal. And if uh-huh. you look, and I know you're aware of this, Harvey, that if you look at the K Street lobbying system, we see how big corporations, like in big oil or big pharmaceutical companies, will spend millions of dollars with K Street lobbyists in Washington, effectively to write legislation that allows there to be almost no regulation in their industry, that's very self-serving and all that. And the Russians followed that, and they started doing that on a massive, massive scale. So today,
when?
If you look
started,
at...
Starting when?
They started, well, certainly over 20 years ago. So if you go back to the late 90s, for example, you will see that, if you remember, Speaker of the House Tom DeLay, who was a Republican, and Jack Abramoff, who was a lobbyist who ended serving several years in jail. Well, they were flying off to Moscow quite a bit. The Russians also, the Russians gave millions of dollars to super PACs that went into Abramoff's pockets. Similarly, they looked at the super PAC system, and there's an oligarch named Leonard Blavatnik who happens to be a naturalized American. Now, he, on the one hand, he's sort of a Russian-Ukrainian oligarch, he's a multi-billionaire, but he's also an American citizen, and he funneled $11 million into the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is run by Mitch McConnell. And that kind of thing happened again and again and again. The National Rifle Association, the Russians give them $70 million, it goes off into the Republican Party. And we see just an awful lot of our electoral system has been taken over by Russian money now.
Now, is most of this Russian money based in fossil fuels? I mean, isn't that the primary source of income in the Soviet Union? And did all these guys make their money in oil and gas?
Well, it's certainly really, really important. And I isolated, I focused sort of on two money pipelines, as I call them, that were flowing in to Trump and his organization and to Paul Manafort and so forth. Some of them came from the aluminum industry, and that's part of it. But the biggest part came from the Ukraine energy trade. And Ukraine is completely dependent on Russia and Turkmenistan for natural gas. And what we see happening, I mean, this is what defines Russia as a kleptocracy. We see that mobsters and oligarchs have effectively seized control of their natural resources. And Russia and Turkmenistan have immense quantities of liquid natural gas. So it was sold, and this is under Putin's directive, it was sold to an intermediary company at low, low, low prices, and then could be sold on the world market at market prices. And that allowed the Russian mafia to skim about $750 million or so a year off the top. And in order to be able to do that, they have to have political control, not just in Russia, but in Ukraine as well. And to keep that political control, they needed a savvy political operative, and they brought in Paul Manafort. And that's how things start going. And when you see what Manafort did for Putin, he got Viktor Yanukovych elected both as prime minister and as president. And Yanukovych was simply a puppet for Vladimir Putin. And there were all sorts of dirty tricks. I itemize them in my book, doing that in 2006 and 2010. And in many ways, I think you can see that almost as a dry run for what Manafort did for Donald Trump in 2016. Again, installing a Russian puppet as president, but this time in the White House.
Right. Well, it's mind-boggling. We're talking with Craig Unger, author of House of Trump, House of Putin from Dutton and Penguin. And, you know, I got to say, reading that book on the airplane, you know, you just hope that the plane lands. You know, like, okay, I've read Dark Money. I read Dark Money about the Koch brothers. I read it from New York to L.A., and then half of it, it's a 600-page book. And then I read the other half coming back. Yours I was able to do in a single flight from Newark to LAX, so that's good. This should be required reading, and I'm hoping that you are going to get on every major media outlet. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we have a mafia guy in the White House. I mean, there's no other way of describing it. You tell me. Isn't the term collusion an understatement? I mean, collusion suggests that you have equal parties or independent parties conspiring across certain borders to do something like steal an election. But Putin owns Trump. I mean, there's no separation between Putin and Trump. Or am I overstating the case here?
No, the sad truth is I think you're being accurate. And you know, writing about this, one has real problems with the language because when I started, I would never have said that we have a Russian asset in the White House. But now I'm absolutely firmly convinced of it. And it's part of an operation that's been going on for years. It's both, I think of it two ways. In one level, it's the greatest intelligence operation of our time, the most successful. Imagine taking over the White House without firing a single shot. And on the other hand, it's the greatest intelligence and national security failure, catastrophe in American history. I mean, we've been attacked three times in the last century at Pearl Harbor. That was a devastating attack that put us into World War II. But it didn't come close to taking over the White House. We had 9/11, which was, again, terrible, and it's right here where I live. I just live five blocks from the World Trade Center.
Uh-huh.
But this was the worst of all, because they actually put their own man in the White House without firing a shot.
Wow. Of course, a lot of us grew up, I'm certainly much older than you are, but with this...
No, movie, you're not, I'm afraid, Harvey.
Well,
I'm just a couple
anyway.
Of years behind you.
All right. And I noticed you went to the University of Michigan Law School, right? Which I did. I went to undergrad.
No. That's not me.
I misread your bio.
No, I did not go to law school. I was an undergrad. I graduated from Harvard, but no post-grad work.
I've heard of Harvard. That's like a small college in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right? So, but at any rate, I grew up, and I think it was in my... Late in my college career, there was a film called The Manchurian Candidate, in which a brainwashed guy from Korea becomes a major political figure. And everybody took it very seriously. And here we are rolling along. I'm not sure Trump has a brain to wash, but, you know, it's easy to dismiss him. Everybody has their talent. I mean, Bush obviously is a terrible businessman, a horrible human being. And so deficient in so many ways. And yet he does have a certain genius for distraction and media manipulation. And, while everybody is every night, night after night, the cable company, you know, Fox is on one side, MSNBC and CNN are on the other side. It's all about Trump. And he has looted our public assets. And, and he's rolling along and nobody is pointing out what you are pointing out in this book that he is basically an asset. of a foreign government, or at least of a mafia operation.
Right. That's very kind of you. But, you know, I'm hoping and thinking the narrative will change very soon. And there's no question that Trump is he's a great showman. He's a reality TV star. And I think he's used those talents to dominate the narrative. But and that makes him that's brought him political power. But we're about to switch to a legal track. And look at the jury in the Manafort case. When you look at these cases, I think we're going to get more and more of this kind of thing where Manafort, will he flip or not? But if he flips, he knows an awful lot. Tell me. I mean, he knows everything about Trump. The same with Michael Cohen. We've had another one later today, more recently today, David Pecker. I don't know if you followed the news in the last few hours.
Yes. Now, David, well, tell us who David Pecker is.
David Pecker is the publisher of the National Enquirer, the tabloid, and he's used it again and again to promote Donald Trump, to tear down Hillary Clinton. But one of his great skills was he was known for a technique as catch and kill. That is, he would catch big stories like about Trump's mistresses and his sexual exploits and pay them off and then kill the story. So this is what Michael Cohen's money was doing. And he was part of the same crime that Michael Cohen was charged with. And now he is flipped as well. He will be testifying against Trump as well. So you have all these aides of Trump, Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, David Pecker, who was his friend at the National Enquirer. And they're all facing crimes that would essentially lead to spending the rest of their lives in jail. But now they're flipping one after another.
Wow. We're talking with Craig Unger, the author of this incredible book. Well, the highly credible, incredible book, House of Trump, House of Putin, about Trump's mafia ties. I was to be joined by two fabulous people. Linda Seeley, are you on the phone? Oh, she never joined us. Kevin
no, Camps? I'm here. I'm here, Harvey.
Oh, you are? Okay. I'm sure you're listening as rapt as I am.
If you want to, this interview is so fascinating, I can hardly breathe.
Kevin Camps, are you on with us? Well, that's
I'm
why
here,
we didn't hear from you because you're not breathing. Kevin Camps, I'm sure you're as fascinated as I am. Craig, when your publicist said you were only be on for half hour, I called my good buddies Linda and Kevin, who are at the cutting edge of the energy, especially nuclear energy, question in America. And I do want to ask you this, because this is critical. And Linda and Kevin, you can chime in. Craig is a really top-level guy, as are Linda and Kevin. Energy. The Russian fortune seems to be totally tied to oil and gas. They have dabbled with nuclear, but it doesn't seem to have gone anywhere. And Linda Seeley lives right next door to the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant in California, and Kevin has been with the nuclear issue. He's from Michigan since about the time that Trump hooked up with the mafia. So the question we have, is there any connection with Trump to the nuclear power industry, and what is the Russian mob doing with nuclear power? It seems to be a side issue for them. Trump Kevin told me about this. Trump in West Virginia. How can you top this? West Virginia said that coal can't be terrorized by foreigners,
right,
but they could terrorize America by destroying our windmills and solar panels. How can you make that up? But tell us, as an expert in a reigning expert in the Russian mob and how it operates, is there a connection between the Russian mob and the nuclear power industry?
To be perfectly honest, I don't know the answer to that question. I was looking at, you know, one of the key things in this was the establishment of different kinds of companies that I guess the term of art is they are opaque intermediaries. And what you see in the way the Russian mafia is able to siphon money off. What happens in the case of Ukraine is they started a company called RUE, that's Rosukla Energo or something. It means Russian-Ukrainian energy. And they take all the liquid natural gas that's being exported. Putin ensures that it goes to RUE, which is owned through various covered shell companies by people who are said to be the Russian mob. I'm talking about people tied to Semyon Mogilevich. And then they buy it at very cheap, artificially low prices, and then put it on the world market at market prices, and they skim off $750 million. So there was a very specific battle.
$750 million a year, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's, you can live on that, can't you?
I think so. Yeah. Well, with food stamps, maybe, but go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, when we look at the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004, or the events of Maidan Square, where dozens of people were murdered by the Russian, by the Ukrainian government, Paul Manafort was there. He was directing things behind the scene. He was working with a guy named Konstantin Kalimnik, who was tied to Russian military intelligence. If you look at the text messages from Manafort's daughters, it's amazing. They say, you know, Dad really has blood on his hands. He ordered the shooting.
Oh, God.
I mean, this is daughter. These are his daughters speaking. You know, what I saw when that was happening was that essentially it foreshadowed what Putin was able and Manafort did in the 2016 election, again, putting a Putin puppet in the presidency.
Is he still there? Is the Putin puppet still running Ukraine?
When I said that, the Putin puppet I was just talking about was Donald Trump. But in Ukraine, Yanukovych fled to Russia and into exile, and he was deemed a traitor in Ukraine. And I mean, that's partly...
Well, being nuclear people, with Kevin Camps and Linda Seeley on the line, let me ask you this. Ukraine, of course, is home to the Chernobyl nuclear plant and the explosion at Chernobyl in 1986, despite all this other stuff, remains one of the most significant events in world history. Now, is there any interface between the mob activities in Ukraine and what's going on at Chernobyl?
Well, you know, I think so. I mean, it would take a lot more investigation, but here's one lead that didn't get a ton of press. It got some, that Michael Flynn, Trump's, you know, national security advisor who has pled guilty to some charges and is now a cooperating witness in the Manafort investigation, who obviously had ties with Russia, was also reported to have been serving as a security consultant for efforts by both American and Russian companies to build atomic reactors in Saudi Arabia. So there's a data point. You know, the Russian nuclear power industry is active in the Middle East, is active in Turkey, is trying to win contracts around the world. And like you said, Harvey, Chernobyl is kind of a big deal, and that was the Russian nuclear industry. And, you know, things have changed in Russia since 1986 and in Ukraine. But some of those same players are there. And I just wanted to mention that Michael Marriott, the executive director of NIRS, who passed on a couple years ago, married a Ukrainian woman who was a leader of the anti-nuclear movement in Ukraine, Tanya Mirza, who is still alive and has their two little children. And I asked Michael during the turmoil in Ukraine, where your other guest mentioned people were shot down on Maidan Square, and he said, yes, indeed, the anti-nuclear movement of Ukraine played a big role in the organization of that rally and that occupation that led to the ouster of Putin's puppet in Ukraine. So there are a lot of connections here going on. And that's how the nuclear power industry in Ukraine itself behaves. They just push people around. They're trying to do at least a power uprate, if not build new reactors at the South Ukraine nuclear power plant. And they're going to flood one of the most historic places in Ukraine, a national park where the Ukrainian nation converted to Christianity many centuries ago. So they behave like mafia. I don't know if they actually are mafia, but they behave that way.
Craig Unger, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm afraid I really don't know anything about the nuclear industry in Russia. It's just not something I know about. I wish I could add to the conversation on that.
Well, let me make a suggestion, a humble suggestion. I'm sure I'm the first talk host to think about this with you. But, you know, Kevin our good friend Michael Marriott, who Linda also knew, have been deeply studying and following the nuclear industry in the Soviet Union. There you go, in Russia. And it's a multi-billion dollar presence that has not gone away. I mean, the Russian economy, as you well know, and certainly this is part of the dynamic with Ukraine having to do with pipelines and other things, is so heavily invested in energy. And there are billions of dollars involved in the Russian nuclear industry, and they have been very aggressive, as Kevin says, and of all places, Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, even within the last couple of weeks, have been talking about building big nuclear power plants. There's no way that the Russian mafia wouldn't be involved in that. And now we have Trump coming out with these statements. This is an insane story, as is everything to do with the nuclear industry, but he was lobbied by one guy at a dinner. They probably went to McDonald's to use an old Korean War emergency provision to bail out nuclear power plants in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere around the country. And this is a parallel universe here to all this mafia stuff with Trump and coal and oil and gas. And there must be some kind of connection there, Craig. And,
well, the scale of that bailout, Harvey, is worth mentioning because it's so huge. It's up to $34 billion per year, according to Tim Judson, the executive director at NERS, and Peter Bradford, and Tyson Slocum at Public Citizen. $17 billion for nuclear, $17 billion for coal. So this is one of the biggest financial crimes. Like your other guest said, these are legal things. They shouldn't be, but they are. They're bending the law to the breaking point. But this is one of the biggest financial crimes going down in the United States, if it goes down.
Yes, and Craig Unger, author of House of Trump, House of Putin, we're getting close to the end here. Let's just say it's something you might want to keep an eye on. I mean,
keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, because it's implausible that the mob and Trump wouldn't be involved in this some way. I mean, to me, it would have seemed that the number one enemy of the Russian mob is renewable energy. I mean, this is the last thing. They are not invested in wind and solar, even though the old Soviet Union, Russia, has limitless wind resources. I mean, limitless. Well, I get in trouble when I say that. Nearly limitless. Linda Seeley, are you breathing yet in San Luis Obispo? Have you noticed any Russians walking over to the Diablo nuclear plant?
I have, but I'm quaking in my boots.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm gonna have you guys, Kevin and Linda, on next week.
Sure.
We were lucky. I was lucky to get Craig in the first place, and now I'm really glad you listened in on this. And Craig, I know that what's going to happen is tomorrow you will stumble on something that has to do with nuclear power. The sarcophagus that they put over the Chernobyl nuclear plant, Kevin, how much was that worth? Do you have an estimate? It was like billions of dollars. There had to have been mob involved.
In the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the biggest building projects in the history of the human race. Is the sarcophagus that went over Chernobyl. I bet, Craig, in your immense resources, you will see some connection. There's no way that the mob was not involved in building that,
right.
That sarcophagus at Chernobyl. It was a project that Donald Trump's father, Fred, would have salivated over, you know, and he would have brought in the Gambini and the Genovese families, as well as the Russian mob. So
yeah, I thought you meant the recovery costs from the catastrophe, but the new sarcophagus was $2 to $3 billion, and it is the largest movable structure in human history. So yeah, the mafia had to be involved on some level in that construction project.
All right, so I'm going to make a prediction here, Craig Unger. I'm going to predict that what you have written
in House of Trump, House of Putin, will help bring down Donald Trump. I don't think he'll be impeached.
Well, I certainly hope so. But at least I wanted to help change the national conversation and awaken people to what's really happened. I think in many ways this changes our whole history of what has happened since the Cold War.
Well, I know that Nixon was involved with the mob. I don't think any other presidents of the United States have been involved with the underworld. Certainly not to the extent of Trump. I mean, Trump has owned and operated, and I think people have to stop talking about collusion. This is way beyond collusion. I mean, he is the baby mama of the Russian mafia. He is owned and operated by Putin, who is not only way smarter than he is, but it also just has all the paper. I mean, you know, there's all this talk about an incriminating tape. They don't need that. I mean, that's why he won't, to me, tell me if I'm wrong, Craig, that's why he won't release his tax returns. All his income is in rubles.
Well, it easily could be something that does appear on his tax returns, and maybe that is why he's not releasing them. And it just shows that he was never vetted properly as a candidate. I mean, and somehow or other, I mean, as I said, this is a guy who should not have a security clearance, and yet he became president of the United States. That is a horrible breach of security.
Is Trump Tower still filled with Russian mafia guys?
You know, I was talking with a guy who actually does maintenance over there and has to make sure part of his task is to look at all the carpets and all the hallways in Trump Tower. And he said about a third of the hallways show no signs of foot traffic after an entire month. In other words, Trump Tower is largely empty. There are not very few people who are actually living there. And that's one of the things you notice here in New York. I live in downtown New York in Tribeca, and there have been a huge number of insanely extravagant condo buildings built where the condos go for $50 million and up. And they're empty. You look at them late at night, and all the lights are off. And they are just for parking money.
Let's hope the White House follows suit. Craig Unger, I hope you've got good security. This book cannot be ignored. House of Trump, House of Putin. Thank you, Linda. And Kevin, I hope you're
reading. Thank you, Harvey.
Because next week you'll be on. Talk to you soon.
Yeah. Thank you, Harvey.
Take care.
Bye. We're going to have a solar-topia.